Allama Mutahhari, Shaheed Mutahhari, one of the students of Imam Khomeini. Of course, he was martyred in the earlier years of the revolution by the Munafiqeen. And he points out beautifully three things that, you know, he was saying that the people needed in this day and age in order to make progress. And he said one of the things was that they need a school of thought that gives a progressive line in terms of understanding the concept of walaya, and through that walaya, the acceptance of that walaya, as it was in the past with the masumin, they have progress. They have prosperity and progress. And this was the thing that was so badly needed, because there was a vacuum in the Muslim world where many schools of thought were there but had reached a dead end because of various circumstances and various things that had happened. But briefly, Sayyidina, if you could say something about that, you in see, the last minute or see, so what, about what you're saying
today. Why he's absolutely right is the fact that Shiite opinion did not say that this leadership or the guidance of the ulama is something which is purely in the time of the occultation,
yes,
during the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
In fact, it's been a process, which has successfully developed, even in the time of Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib's time.
Yes, yes.
You know, sometimes people say that the faqih or the jurisprudence has only responsibility in the absence of the imam. But no, in the presence of the imam, a jurist was active. Who was that jurist who was active? When Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib sent Malik al-Ashtar to Misr, he sent the most prominent scholar of his time.
Exactly.
To go to Misr and extrapolate on the needs of the people on the basis of the fiqh that Amir al-Mu'mineen had taught him.
Well, this is the thing about the beauty of this school of thought, isn't it?
Exactly.
The most knowledgeable, the most competent, the most...
Exactly.
You know, has the expertise to handle these
and
affairs.
And you see, I mean, just as a joke, you know, Imam Ali did not give Malik al-Ashtar a fax machine saying, if you're stuck, give me a fax, I'll give you a fatwa. No, he had the best quality, the most competent to do that. And that's what we see.
These are people in their own right who can
indeed
do this.
But these individuals do not claim to be masums.
No, they're not. No.
But they have the recognition of the authority of the masum to apply over the people.
Exactly, the expertise.
And this is
there.
What Imam Khomeini was trying to articulate in the meaning of the Wilayat al-Faqih.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyidina. That was that's wonderfully concluded our program today. But we'll carry on with the next session, listeners, to the third phase of this very important revolution. But we'll do that in the next program. But thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all.
The last message of the late Imam.
Oh, you deprived people of the world. Oh, you Muslims and Muslim countries of the world, rise up and fight for your rights. Do not be afraid of the propaganda batteries of the superpowers and their mercenary agents. Drive out from your lands your wicked rulers who hand over your earnings to your enemies and the enemies of Islam. You yourselves and the dedicated public servants should take charge of the affairs of your country. Gather together, all of you, under the honoring banner of Islam, and fight the enemies of Islam and of the deprived people of the world. Advance toward an Islamic sovereign government with so many free and independent republics. If you realize this, the arrogant powers shall retreat to their own places, and all the deprived people will come to inherit the earth and attain guardianship over it, looking forward to the day when Allah's promise shall be fulfilled.
Last year, during the holy month of Ramadan, Saudi Arabia aired a TV series called Harun, starring unprecedentedly Jewish characters. Fans praised the show for highlighting the history of Jewish communities in the Persian Gulf, but critics blasted it as a barefaced attempt to reshape Arab views of Israel to pave the way for formal relations, or what many in the Arab world call normalization. This year, during the month of Ramadan, something more seriously happened to reinforce the pro-Israeli tendency of leading Arab media outlets in Saudi Arabia, above all, Al Arabiya Media Company. The recent escalation between the Israeli regime and the Palestinian people grabbed the headlines across the world. People took to the streets in order to show their solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine, condemning the savagery of Israel's indiscriminate attacks. Against such a backdrop, many observers found it shocking that Riyadh-based TV channel Al Arabiya took an anti-Palestinian gesture, not least because the network reflects the kingdom's official stance towards the Palestinian cause and the occupation issue as a whole. As a result, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has called on the Palestinian people and the rest of the Arab world to boycott Al Arabiya for its dubious pro-Israeli agendas. The Front has condemned the channel for distorting the realities in the occupied territories, all in favor of the Israeli regime. In a recent communique, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine lashed out at Al Arabiya for broadcasting false things about the Palestinians, such as describing the resistance movement as a terrorist initiative, while picturing the illegal regime and its settlers as the victims. In one of what the Front called a sheer slander, Al Arabiya claimed that the leaders of the resistance movement left Gaza, along with their families, for Egypt, ahead of the all-out war.
I think the story as a whole needs to be looked at historically. Within the Palestinian struggle and the situation there, if you study the media coverage, not just across the Arab world, but across internationally, there are two main strategies that are taking place. One is to dehumanize the Palestinian people, and you see that in the kind of language that's used, and you see that in terms of the comparison of the life and the value of a Palestinian compared to an Israeli, for example. And the second strategy is to basically dehumanize them and to blame the victim. So the dehumanization is very clear in the language, in media, including in the Saudi media that you've seen. And the other aspect, which is the blaming the victim, which is very carefully laid out by Edward Said, the Palestinian writer, where the aggressor becomes the person who's being attacked by the Palestinians, which is clearly not true if you look at it in militarily terms and political terms and in human rights terms, of course.
It's not the first time the kingdom-based Al Arabiya is covering the developments in Palestine in favor of the Israelis, but this time it has adopted a more explicit approach. Their guests and experts intentionally blame Hamas for what has happened in recent weeks in Gaza and the rest of the occupied territories, without addressing the root causes of the tensions, such as the attempt to illegally evict some Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, or attacking Muslim worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. At the same time, they underline the effectiveness of Israel's Iron Dome in intercepting Hamas rockets fired from Gaza.
These very relatively small stories are important because the whole language of soft power and hard power is what we're seeing at play here. the soft language that's used and the hard politics that's at play is what undermines the situation of the Palestinian people. And I think it is a question of language. It is a question of preparing the minds of the international community for a situation where there can be some enforced state on the Palestinian people.
This time, the Saudi leading media refrained from paying even lip service to sending a clear signal to both the Palestinian people and the Israeli regime. Whereas Al Arabiya didn't interview a resistance movement official during the escalation, the channel talked on several occasions to the Israeli regime's military spokesman, Avichai, providing him with the opportunity to justify Tel Aviv's war crimes. By the same token, Emirati leading media outlets relied heavily on the style and content of Western wire services. An editorial in El Ittihad was entitled "No to Violence and Hate." It featured lukewarm calls for an end to tensions in East Jerusalem al-Quds and took issue with practices which violate the sanctity of Al-Aqsa mosques. No doubt the piece was in line with the UAE's current stance on Israel, following the normalization agreement signed between the two last year.
Well, I think we have to be careful when we use the word normalization, because actually normalization from the point of view of the aggressor is the suppression of the normal. This normalization which the Americans are trying to push through is actually violence, it's actually aggression. And so that's why the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist this so-called normalization. Normalization to the people of Palestine would mean the freedom of Palestine. Normalization to the people of Palestine would be the right to their own land, the right of return, the right of the return of refugees, the right to eat, the right to drive, the right to work, the right to sleep without the threat of bombardment. So this is normalization from the point of view of the Palestinians. And I think language, again, is very important in terms of the press, in terms of media. I think we have to be very careful of this phrase, normalization, because on the face value, it seems very acceptable. You know, who wouldn't want things to be normal? But normal for who? And who determines what's normal?
Meanwhile, Sharjah-based broadsheet Al-Khalij framed Israeli strikes in Gaza, which have killed dozens of people, including children, a response to rocket fire by Palestinian factions from the besieged coastal strip, echoing what the Israeli regime has said while justifying its war crimes. It's a while the Saudi media have softened their tone when covering developments in the occupied territories. The tightly controlled media in Saudi Arabia clearly reflect the attitude of the ruling family in the kingdom towards the Palestinian cause. While the kingdom has not officially normalized ties with the Israeli regime, it has made it clear over and over again that establishing formal ties with Tel Aviv is no longer a taboo subject in a country that claims to be a leading supporter of the Palestinians.
Well, I think the strategy of some of the Arab media, which is controlled by the different countries, whether you're talking about Saudi Arabia or UAE or any of those states, is to put across the point of view, the political point of view and the political demand of the governments of those countries. And we all know that there's been a move by the United States over the past 10 years to try and normalize relationships between some Arab countries and Israel in order to embed the Israeli state in a much firmer way within the Middle East. So that's the geopolitics that's happening here.
The disappointing covering of the recent developments in the occupied territories by Saudi and Emirati media outlets is part of a bigger picture where Palestine is no longer in the fore.
مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. The eminent among those who disbelieved from his people said, "This is not but a man like yourselves who wishes to take precedence over you. And if Allah had willed to send a messenger, he would have sent down angels. We have not heard of this among our forefathers."
So, if you have been previously with us, dear listeners, you know that we started to talk about the second section of the chapter. In this section, Almighty Allah talks about saving the Prophet, Prophet Noah and his followers. In the 23rd verse, Almighty Allah talked about the Arch Prophet, that he was the bearer of the news of monotheism. In the 24th verse, the Almighty Allah in the Holy Quran states, فَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ قَوْمِهِ مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ. But the chiefs of those who disbelieved from among his people said, "This is nothing but a mortal like you." يريد أن يتفضل عليكم. He intends to gain superiority over you. ولو شاء الله لأنزل ملائكة. If Allah had pleased to send any prophet, he surely could have sent down the angels. ما سمعنا بهذا في آبائنا الأولين. We have not heard of this kind of invitation among our ancestors of old. So, in the previous verse, the Holy Quran said that we sent the Prophet Noah to his folk, to his people, and he said, "O my people, worship Allah, you have no other God save him," and this is the invitation to monotheism. Now, the elite were the most intractable of those who oppose the prophets, and this is what they do here. فَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ قَوْمِهِ. the chiefs of those who disbelieved from among his people said that this is a mortal like you, this is not a prophet, and etc. So the prophets had come to guide mankind, but the unbelievers used to say that a heavenly messenger should not be like a simple human being. Now, by this kind of reasoning, and because of this, the rich and conceited elite among Noah's folk used to say that this is not a prophet, this is only a mortal like you who seeks to dominate you, so you have to be aware of him. The verse says, فَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ قَوْمِهِ مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ يُرِيدُ أَنْ يَتَفَضَّلَ عَلَيْكُمْ. The chiefs of those who disbelieved from among his people said, this is nothing but a mortal like you. He intends to gain superiority over you. يُرِيدُ أَنْ يَتَفَضَّلَ عَلَيْكُمْ.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
series
of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, they saw Noah's humanity as a defect, and as a result, they accused him of self-aggrandizement, and that all he had said about Allah, about monotheism, about religion, they were all mere plots to achieve this aim. This is what those people, الْمَلَأُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ قَوْمِهِ, those chiefs of the disbelievers, told the normal people. Then they added, وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ لَأَنزَلَ مَلَائِكَ, and if Allah had pleased, He surely could have sent down the angels. So, this unfounded argument is not yet stopped. They continued and said, مَا سَمِعْنَا بِهَذَا فِي آبَائِنَا الْأَوَّلِينَ, we had not heard this among our ancestors of old. Of course, when facing correct logic, one must not rely on national culture and the imitation of one's ancestors to defend the existing situation. Instead, one must follow the divine call of his prophet. So you see, they don't stop in with the first reasoning. They continue saying, مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ, this is a mortal like you. يُرِيدُ أَنْ يَتَفَضَّلَ عَلَيْكُمْ, he pleases to gain superiority over you. وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ لَأَنزَلَ مَلَائِكَةً, Allah could have sent down the angels, but He hasn't. And then at the end, مَا سَمِعْنَا بِهَذَا فِي آبَائِنَا الْأَوَّلِينَ, we have not heard this invitation from among our ancestors. This is how they used to mislead the people. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program.
We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues that are raised during the upbringing of our children, who are the future of our community. And to help us with our questions, we have Sheikh Masumi. Assalamu alaikum. Sheikh Masumi, thank you very much for being with us.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So we started an interesting discussion last episode, last time we met each other, and it was about how youth have a very soft heart, which came to a surprise to me, since I used to be a youth back in the old days.
Yeah, definitely, and we were unaware of our this beautiful quality.
Yeah, exactly. And so you distinguish very, very nicely that it's one thing to be soft-hearted, but it's another thing to be obedient. And we say that teenagers are soft-hearted, but we're not saying that they're obedient. Soft-hearted means that they are sensitive and they are ready to accept what's correct. But we ended last episode by saying that parents sometimes don't understand how to treat their teenagers. And that's where a lot of the conflicts arise. That's why they're always fighting with their kids, with their teenagers. And so let's dedicate this episode to giving advice to the parents out there about how they should address and face and help their teenagers.
Yeah, it is a very important question. I think we have spoken about this in our some previous episodes. So just a little bit, I will give you a few points. We have discussed so many rules that how to treat our teenagers, especially with all these sensitivity and with all their this disobediency. So we spoke that there is one rule, asle taghaful, and taghaful means to ignore. Yeah, we have spoken a lot about this.
You haven't listened
to them, you haven't understood what they are doing. And another rule is to respect, you know, respect your teenagers. Although they may be, you know, disobedient towards you, they don't listen to you, but still always be respectful towards them. Because respecting them, you know, it leads them to be respectful towards you, you know. And there are some other rules also that how we can respect them, how we can, and one other important rule is to be a good listener. If you are a good listener to your teenager, then definitely it will help him to be obedient towards you. So likewise, these few rules, if you carefully act upon these rules and apply them in your daily life, then definitely they will become obedient too with you. But it takes time and gradually and slowly.
So we said that first to ignore some of the mistakes that they make. And what is the threshold? I mean, there's obviously a line where we won't ignore anymore after that. Where is that threshold?
Definitely, you know, it depends how much your teenager has done mistakes and how many times, you know. Usually we speak about, you know, in general, if your teenager does any mistake in front of you, don't, you know, catch him on the spot and say, you have done this mistake, why did you this? You know, you don't become angry and upset. Because becoming angry and upset at the moment, you know, at that moment, it will give bad consequences.
We'll put them in the defensive.
Yeah. So if you ignore them and let them know that you have understood by some, you know, somehow, then it helps them that he understands that you have understood this mistake I have done, but still you didn't do anything, you ignore me. This gives them, you know, confidence, and slowly they can share with their problems with you.
Thanks. Let's take a break now, and then we'll be back after the break to further this discussion.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking with Sheikh Masumi on the soft-heartedness of teenagers. So, Sheikh Masumi, when we're talking about the soft-heartedness of teenagers, you said that we have to help them utilize that soft heart. How can we do that as they're grown-ups?
Before I answer to your question, let me share with you that if they have a soft heart, what is the benefit of having a soft heart? So briefly, let me tell you that if someone has a soft heart, then it's easy for others to guide them, or for himself it is easy to get the guidance. You know, if you have a very soft base, you know, ready base, then you can easily get the guidance. And another benefit is if you are a soft-hearted person, then you easily forgive others' mistakes. Yeah, this is the second quality. And the third quality is if you have a soft heart, so you always look for the righteous, look for the right thing, you know. These are some qualities which our teenagers have. So now it is parents' duty to utilize in such a way that they keep their this softness, soft heart.
So let's start from the top. They're ready to accept the truth.
Right.
How should parents present this truth?
There are a lot of ways how to interact with your teenagers that they keep this soft heart, and according to this they obey and they utilize in their life. So according to ahadith of Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they always said to parents that teenagers' age is a very sensitive, and we have to treat them keeping in mind this soft heart and this, you know, sensitivity. We should keep always in our mind that they are very sensitive, they are soft-hearted. Being this, they are a little bit disobedient also. If we keep this in our mind and treat them and behave with them, then definitely we can provide them their good guidelines.
Can you give us a practical example? How would you do that with your own son?
For example, you know, nowadays because of social media, our kids are very too much indulged with these social media and internet and playing games. For example, I have three sons. You know, my bigger son is 16, 17 years old. So he usually plays games because of this pandemic, corona situation. You know, unfortunately, most of these students, parents, they have the same issue.
You're going to have a tough time convincing them not to
play. Yeah, convincing them. So, for example, if I go straight to them and say to them that this, you are wasting your time, you are, you know, harming your eyes, your mind, and you are wasting a lot of money on these meaningless things,
it's going to create resistance.
He cannot understand that this is meaningless, this is not beneficial for him, this is wasting of time. No. For this, you have to use some
tricks.
Rules and tricks, yeah.
Let's keep you right there so that we can take a short break just before we reveal those tricks. If you want to hear about them, stay tuned. We'll be back very soon.
Ya muqiyal khayran, ya muqiyal khayran, ya muqiyal.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Sheikh Masumi, and we're talking about the soft-heartedness of teenagers, actually. So the first element, we said, the first consequence of soft-heartedness is that they are ready to accept the truth, but they're a little bit resistant to it. And we asked for a practical example where you said, oh, your own son is 16 and is playing with his mobile phone a lot because of the pandemic. But it's not going to work if you go straight to him and tell him that you're harming your eyes, you're wasting your life. It's going to create resistance. What do you do?
As we have spoken in our previous some episodes, that these do's and don'ts, usually parents use a lot. Yeah, do this, don't do this. They have a long list of these do's and don'ts. They always argue about this with their teenagers, which harms, you know, their relationship between parent and their teenagers. So according to riwayat and according to Islamic teachings, there are very, very useful and golden rules. If you learn them and utilize them in your life, then you will not feel that he is contradicting with you, he is disputing with you, and he is arguing with you.
So we have about 2 minutes. Can you list these rules for us?
So, as I said, if you respect him since the child age, the foremost, the very important rule is respect. Respect and respect. So, if, for example, you have a son from age zero, you started respecting him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, till 11, 12, then this relation of respecting, you respecting him and he's respecting you, this becomes very, very strong. You know, it shows result after 14, 15 years. This is one of the rules. Okay. The another rule is you become friend with your son or daughter. If you're a mother or father, you become friend and you behave them very friendly. For example, if your son is, you know, interested in games, you also take some time and play some games with him. The games he plays, you also sit with him, discuss with him. This builds the friendship between you and your son. Likewise, listening also, if you listen carefully, whatever he says, definitely in future, this will give him a chance to listen to you. So like this, we have a lot of other rules. If you apply these rules in your life, then definitely it will work with your teenagers.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing some of those rules with us. So I guess it all boils down to respect one way or another. If you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam Radio, and you'll find us right there. Islamic upbringing. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Telegram as well. Simply search Call of Islam Radio, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
As Israel enters its second week of indiscriminate bombings, hundreds of Palestinians have been martyred and many more wounded, with figures climbing into the thousands of injured. The collective mainstream media and Western governments have attempted to portray the onslaught as a mere crisis and to provide cover for Israel's crimes. On this program, we seek to expose those crimes and report the real story that Israel doesn't want you to see. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 10th, 2021, Israel began an offensive against the Gaza Strip, bombing the Palestinian enclave by land and by air. For several weeks prior, tensions were growing rapidly in occupied Palestine as Israeli forces cracked down on Palestinian protesters. The protests first began at Damascus Gate in Jerusalem as a result of restrictions that Israel had imposed on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan, as well as Israel's plans to evict Palestinian families living in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Earlier that day on May 10th, Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at Palestinians while they were inside praying, leaving over 90 people injured. Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam, drew widespread condemnation and rebuke from Muslims and non-Muslims alike. As a result, the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, which is also in power in the Gaza Strip, issued an ultimatum, demanding that Israel immediately withdraw from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israel ignored this, and Hamas responded shortly thereafter with rocket fire. Israel then began an offensive against Gaza, launching several airstrikes which have continued every day since May 10th. Thousands of Israeli reservists were called up, and there was a genuine fear that a ground invasion was about to take place. Just like in previous wars against Gaza in 2009 and 2014, Israel has been purposely targeting public and health infrastructure in Palestine. This is a war crime under the Geneva Convention. As a result of Israel's bombings, the only salination plant in the Gaza Strip has been put out of action. The only clinic that is able to carry out COVID-19 tests has also been damaged. 6 out of 10 electricity lines have been cut, as if the electricity situation wasn't already bad enough to begin with, people living in Gaza can get barely 4 to 5 hours of power a day. According to the Palestinian Water Authority, water supplies in Gaza have now been reduced by 40% as a result of the Israeli bombardments. Gaza's water infrastructure has been hit so severely that human waste and sewage are now overflowing onto the streets. Israel has also bombed the main roads that lead to Al-Shifa Hospital, making it more difficult for the wounded to reach the biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry reported that one of its clinics was put out of action. Doctors Without Borders also reported damage to their clinic, and there are photographs all over Gaza of roads completely decimated. Health workers and residents alike describe horrific scenes of seeing loved ones and neighbors buried alive under the rubble, of digging out the deceased from underneath twisted metal and slabs of concrete. The result of Israeli warplanes indiscriminately bombing Gaza. A nurse at Al-Shifa Hospital told Al Jazeera that she had, quote, never seen anything like this in her life. There were body parts collected on hospital beds and unbearable scenes. On May 15th, an Israeli airstrike hit the offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera in Gaza. There were no deaths or injuries. However, despite several pleas from the Associated Press for Israel not to bomb the building and to allow them to gather belongings, they were ignored. And the entire 12-story building was leveled by Israeli warplanes as the entire world watched it collapse into rubble. Israel is openly bombing the buildings of some of the largest news outlets on the planet, and the so-called liberal democracies of the West say nothing and shrug it off like nothing happened. Videos have been pouring out of Gaza, one after the other, showing entire residential buildings collapsing under Israeli bombs. Within the first week, the number of deaths on the Israeli side has amounted to 10 people. On the Palestinian side, hundreds have been killed and thousands more have been injured. The majority of them are civilians, not Hamas. In the first week alone, Israel killed over 212 Palestinians. 61 of them were children. That's almost one-third of the casualties. I repeat, almost one-third of the casualties are children. The Gaza Health Ministry reports that over 1,400 Palestinians have been wounded. The UN says that over 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced and over 2,000 have lost their homes. And just to give you another idea of the level of cruelty and barbarism enacted by the Israelis, in the same week, multiple Palestinian families were wiped out entirely by Israeli bombs. On Friday, May 14th, the entire Tanani family in northern Gaza was killed by an Israeli airstrike, which completely flattened their home. The next day, on May 15th, 10 family members of the Al-Hadidi family were killed by an Israeli airstrike on the Shati refugee camp in Gaza. And this is always the case. Every single time Israel attacks Gaza, the death toll is incomparable. The number of casualties is always so much higher on the Palestinian side. The Israelis have an air force, they have a navy, they have drones, they receive billions in military aid every single year from the U.S. This is asymmetrical warfare at best, and it's a bloodbath at worst. Joining me is Dina Almuti. She's a trauma-informed clinician and has written extensively for Electronic Intifada. Thanks for coming on. It's a privilege to have you, Dina.
The honor is mine. The honor is mine.
Right now in Gaza, almost one-third of the casualties are children. And we talk a lot about the killed and the wounded, which is horrific in of itself. But what kind of effect does this violence have on the children who survive? I mean, what does that leave them with?
I guess to me, calling it a war simplifies it. There are no two sides in equal defense of each other. It's a merciless genocide that's being committed against people who are unable to leave, unable to get shelter, unable to get medical attention. You know, it's wholesale slaughter, state-sanctioned genocide. And what effect does that have on an entire population, on generation after generation? It's human devastation on an unimaginable scale. I mean, Palestinian children close their eyes and see nothing but devastation. They open their eyes to the same, and they grow up fluent in a language of grief and trauma. Trauma is like a second language to them, essentially. It rearranges their lives. It interrupts it, if you will, over and over and over again, one onslaught after another. Their thoughts run on death, destruction, calamity. Under those conditions, the chronic traumatic stress becomes so, you know, common that it's their normal. You know, the trauma actually embeds itself in their cells. It alters their DNA. And that passes on one generation after another. It actually becomes generational. So talk about like developmental disruption. That's exactly what Israel is intent on, to disrupt lives, to disrupt the normal progression. It wants to constantly have one assault after another to disrupt a normal development from occurring.
So do we have any figures? Do we know what percentage of children are diagnosed? I mean, what about those who are never diagnosed, who may have some trauma or scars? I mean, do we have any idea of these consequences in terms of numbers?
I would tell people to, you know, to turn to DCI, Defense for Children International. They have amazing figures to, you know, they will document a lot of what's happening. But even then, I feel like that's scratching the surface of what's happening. I mean, even children in Gaza right now who are receiving psychosocial care, you know, for what happened during the last onslaught are being killed. As of, you know, today and yesterday. And so how do you keep up? How do you keep track of who's suffering?
Regarding chemical, biological weapons, we've seen reports that Israel's potentially been using white phosphorus in the last days, and we know they did in 2009. I mean, what does that do to someone whose body, whose brain is still developing?
Oh, the effect that it would have on, like entire generations are going to suffer immeasurable consequences to their immune system, endocrine system, their neurological system. This is all very calculated. Mind you, none of it is by accident. It's all very, very calculated and by design. These endocrine disruptors will affect fertility. When I was there in 2014, I saw children born with ambiguous genitalia, with all kinds of cancers. This is affecting so much more than just, you know, what you see on the surface. This is a very generational thing designed to destroy generation after generation after generation, all very calculated, and none of it by accident or just to create destruction on a large scale. It's designed to create destruction for generations to come, even in unborn children, if you will. So it's incomprehensible.
So, you know, Dina, lastly, we've seen a massive general strike all across Palestine, perhaps the biggest in Palestinian history. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Does it make you feel hopeful at all?
I think this is a monumental time in history. We're going to look back, and when people ask, where were you when this or that happened? Were you standing on the right side? Were you standing on the side of the oppressed? Did you choose to make a conscious effort to speak up even when it wasn't as popular or when, you know, wasn't good for your career or what have you? I do have hope. I will always have hope as a Palestinian. I think a lot more needs to be done. We need to see more than lip service. We need more than what's being done, because I feel like this world continues to fail Palestine in every conceivable way, but I do have hope.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Reacting to Israel's latest attacks on Gaza, the response from the majority of Western governments is just as you'd expect. Lackluster at best, and at worst, a complete whitewashing of Israeli crimes. Some European countries thought that it would be a wise idea to take a side, and of course they decided to pander to the Israeli lobby. Czech President Zeman ordered that an Israeli flag be raised over Prague Castle in a show of solidarity with the Israeli occupation, or as most would correctly put it, in a show of hostility to the Palestinians. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, also decided to fly the Israeli flag, which was raised over the Chancellery building in the capital, Vienna. Now, to say this was done in extremely poor taste is an understatement. Austria is a neutral country, at least officially, and Vienna has long boasted to be the world's capital of international diplomacy. It's home to one of the United Nations headquarters, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and many other international organizations. And this isn't just about violating supposed neutrality, but this move shows that the Austrian and Czech governments to be on the side of the Israeli occupation, on the side of the oppressors. The United Kingdom's Foreign Minister Dominic Raab condemned Hamas firing rockets at Israel, but of course said nothing of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which has killed hundreds. This was followed up by a readout from the White House regarding U.S. President Joe Biden's call with Netanyahu, in which Biden reaffirmed Israel's, quote, right to defend itself, whatever that means. Joining me is Jennifer Levenstein. She's a freelance journalist, human rights activist, professor of Middle East studies, and also works with Eyewitness Palestine. Thank you for taking the time, Jennifer. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jennifer, I want to start out with the Biden administration's response to what's happening now in Gaza. What are your thoughts on what Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, said, Secretary of State Blinken? I mean, what did you think of their assessment and response to what Israel is doing right now in Palestine?
I think their responses have been absolutely criminal. And I don't honestly know if they are criminal intentionally or whether these two people are just incredibly ignorant. When you hear the President of the United States saying that the aggressor in a conflict has the right to self-defense, there's something very, very wrong with that response. The aggressor in any military situation is not the one defending itself. So I've been very disappointed both with his response and also with Secretary of State Antony Blinken's response, who said yesterday that there was no equivalence between the Hamas organization and Israel, and said that Israel had the right to self-defense. So once again, he's got it completely backwards.
Okay, so I mean, what do you say to people who would respond that basically, you know, Palestinians, that Hamas, they're the ones who started everything, and that basically they're responsible for any civilian casualties? I mean, what do you respond to people who say that?
I would say that if they're looking at a situation in a very, very short-term setting, that they can possibly come away with that view. But even if they take into consideration the events of the last 2 weeks, Israel is the aggressor. Israel went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque and beat up worshipers during the holiest holiday for Muslims. Israel is expelling citizens from the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Israel is the one who's backing up Jewish settlers who are running around in East Jerusalem and elsewhere saying death to Arabs, and we're burning Arabs today. Israel is the one that is causing displacement, dispossession, home demolitions, you name it. That is the aggressor. That's not somebody defending itself. The responses to these actions by Israel are resistance. Resistance is legal under international law in whatever form the resistors wish to take.
So, I mean, speaking of international law, at the United Nations Security Council, just in the past week, the United States three times blocked a statement which called for a ceasefire. Everyone else in the UN Security Council was in favor of it. But the United States blocked it because of language that would have condemned Israel's actions. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I call the veto power in the United Nations Security Council, I call it the tyranny of the veto, because, of course,